I want to get the 3D version of that individual, right? I want to know all the stuff outside of the 9 to 5, because actually, like, some of our best employees, right, might not have a great CV, unquote, unquote, but they've got this utter drive and this growth mindset. And in their spare time, they're learning all this, they're consuming all this content and listening to this podcast. So I'm really interested in.
Welcome to the podcast, where we introduce you to incredible humans who share their journeys with the mission to inspire you to harness your own inner tenacity to drive your life and career forward. And now, your host, Adam Posner.
Hey, everybody, welcome back to the podcast where I bring in the best and the brightest in the world of business, marketing, and personal growth to help you harness your inner tenacity and drive your career forward. My guest today on the podcast is Mark Chaffee. Mark is the CEO of tech hiring platform Hackajob, a business he co-founded in 2014 at the age of 20 while studying at university. Since then, Hackajob has raised $35 million in investment to back the platform's growth, grown to a team of 120 people, and is the largest tech hiring platform in the UK and the US. We have a lot to talk about, so many different areas. Mark is here in the States, in New York, and I'm happy to chat with him. Mark, let's do it. Mark, welcome to the podcast.
Adam, thank you so much for having me. Super excited to have a conversation today.
Let's do it. Awesome. So I want to hit the rewind button here. And we were kind of joking before, like, how does someone fall into this sector? How does someone fall into the wonderful world of recruitment that we live in? But I want to hit the rewind button to university. What did you intend to be studying at school?
Yeah, so I guess jumping back one page before university.
Please.
I was always interested in business, and I'd set up a couple of what I called like hustles rather than businesses. Me and a friend would import perfume from Alibaba back when BlackBerry Messenger was a thing, and then sell that perfume via BBM all around a city in England that I grew up in a place called Southampton. And then ended up running a music studio with that guy for a few years where he'd record grime music, which is a version of UK rap, again in Southampton. And then ended up doing like nightclub promotions and would run social events, etc. So when the time...
Always a hustler. I respect that. Love it.
Totally. So then when the time came for university, my real goal was to move to London. I saw London as the opportunity, and university was the easiest way to move to London. My mum's a head teacher and was very adamant that I do go to university. I had good grades. So my thought process was, well, university is the best way to get me to London. What's the best university I can get into? And ended up studying at King's College London, which is a great university. I was there for 3 years and had an incredible time, met some of my best friends, and met my co-founder. So whilst I was at King's, I was studying business management, which candidly was useless for an entrepreneur. It was not a course designed to set up a business. It was really a course designed for people who wanted to go into investment banking or management consulting.
It's more about the fundamentals versus the true, you know, understanding of entrepreneurship and a lot of those principles.
Totally. But outside of the degree, I joined the business club, which was one of the societies at King's, and competed in what was the student version of The Apprentice. So here you obviously had Donald Trump in the UK. We had Lord Sugar, who runs The Apprentice. And basically the university societies got together.
The Dragon's Den, right? Yeah.
Yeah. And the university society got together to organize it. So in my first year at university, I ended up taking part in the National Student Apprentice, and my team ended up winning the National Student Apprentice, which was a super fun project to go through. Unfortunately, the final bit wasn't to pitch a business idea. We had to like do this whole campaign for the Department for Trade and why Britain should be more outward facing and that piece, which was interesting.
So you caught the bug. You had the bug, right? You had that
totally.
But you had that even before university, right?
Yeah. And it's really interesting. I don't really know where it comes from. Actually, my mum and dad met on a picket line and are socialists. So I was raised with that kind of backdrop from a politics background. And so it's not like anyone in my family had gone on to set up businesses. My dad's granddad had a very successful building company, but that was many generations before. But yeah, I had the bug, and university enabled me to scratch it a little bit more as well.
It's so interesting too. Both my parents are retired New York City teachers and not entrepreneurial, not business owners. And my brother's in education too. And I'm an entrepreneur. I'm a small business owner. And so he's like, where does that come from? Right? Is it in the DNA? Is it in the hustle? And I think it has something to do with our personality and wanting to build and create and change things. So you're in university, and I'd love to hear the story, right? Because you created something without having worked in the industry or even out in the workforce, right? But you saw something and you saw a problem and there was no potential solution for it, and you created that solution. Let's hear the origin story, man.
Yeah, for sure. So through the business club at King's, I met Mike, who ended up being my co-founder, Razvan. Razvan and I worked on a number of different projects together. And it's amazing how serendipitous life can be. We were both at a startup event on between my second and third year of university, this rooftop event, very nice in London. And I bumped into Razvan, I hadn't seen him for a while. And he said, we should grab coffee tomorrow. And I was like, sure, I'll grab coffee. So we grabbed coffee, and it was actually Razvan's initial idea and insight into HackerJob. He had been working inside a staffing agency and looking at how that works from a, and Razvan is one of those people that's incredibly gifted, both technically and commercially, did an undergrad in comp sci and a master's in marketing. And so could kind of see it from both lens and said, you know, I think there's an opportunity here to build a skills-based matching platform where actually we primarily match talent based on their technical skills rather than a recruiter kind of calling up candidates and trying to screen them in Java when they have no idea. So he approached me with this idea, and I was desperate to find something in my final year of university. The last thing I wanted was to go and get a corporate job or a grad job. So I jumped at the opportunity.
Last thing I want to do is work for the man. Screw that.
Honestly. So when Razvan gave me this opportunity, I jumped at it. And it meant that during my final year of university, I spent far more time with Razvan and our early team in the King's College London cafeteria working on HackerJob than I did studying. But we ended up being able to apply for Techstars and gone to Techstars that summer, which was amazing and kind of really fueled us from there. Razvan had some amazing early contacts to raise some small angel money. So that was really how it all began.
Let's talk about, and we were chatting before we hit record, like not every founder needs a co-founder, right? You don't need to have a co-founder. But where is it advantageous, right? Like where are those elements and what are some of those kind of guidelines? Because sometimes it works out and sometimes it doesn't. But does every founder need a co-founder?
I think building a startup is a completely, building a successful startup is a completely outlier event. Therefore, there isn't a formula to make it work. I think I was incredibly fortunate to have Razvan as my co-founder. He was a little bit more experienced. He'd done a couple of startups before. Like I said, it was his initial idea and his initial contact that we raised angel money from. And I learned so much and still learn so much from my conversations with Raz. We were literally catching up back end of last week, and it's always awesome to have that relationship. And I think what worked really well for us is it's like 1 + 1 = 3. Like we make each other better, and that's what you really, really want in a co-founder. And you know, there probably isn't anybody on this planet I've spent more time with than him, because you know, for 7-8 years we worked, you know, 100 hours a week on this business together, you know, grafting and grinding. So I think that for me, it worked out, and I'm incredibly fortunate. But obviously, there are many examples where, you know, people have built great companies and it's not been a co-founer. So I think that it's not one size fits all, but certainly for me, I found it so beneficial.
There had to be early conflicts. How did you learn? I mean, listen, you were only in university. You haven't really spent too much time in the quote unquote proper workforce, but learning how to handle, you know, interpersonal business conflicts. There had to be conflicts, there had to be disagreements, and hopefully obviously in a productive way where it led to innovation. But how did you manage those early conflicts?
I think about this a lot, and I think there's something beautiful about being so naive to not understand how work is meant to work. So because I'd never worked in an office environment,
100%.
And never like being privy to corporate politics or office politics, or really you say this, but you mean this, you know, in this whole perspective, we just approached it through like how two humans would approach anything, right? Which was, we had the same goal. We wanted to build this amazing company. We would have these amazing brainstorming sessions where we would really push each other. And I think one of the things I enjoyed and enjoy most about my conversations with Raz is he's so got such a high IQ. And that sparring partner, that's somebody where you can really debate ideas, discuss ideas, and get to much better outcomes, comes back to that 1+1=3 mm-hmm. model. So I actually think the naivety I had of never really working in a work environment was actually a massive blessing in disguise.
I think it's a complete advantage. So I want to dig a little bit deeper into this insight. The show at its roots is about recruiting and talent and HR and people and all those kind of things. Skills-based matching, especially when it comes to technology. Now, obviously, there's a lot of very skilled technical recruiters out there. But at its core, most technical roles require certain technical requirements. Let's dig a little bit deeper into that, you know, the concept of skills matching. Was it the fact, Mark, was it not another product out there? I mean, what was going to be your core point of differentiation in the market?
So there was a number of assessment products out there that, right. you know, once you had found a candidate that you wanted to interview and maybe they'd done a first or second stage, you would put them through one of these technical assessments to validate their skills. I think what we were really interested in and still really are interested in is how do you do that at the sourcing stage? How can you do skill validation up front and then use that as a primary data point to drive sourcing? And it was really through this lens of meritocratic hiring, right? Actually, a joke, I don't have the data to prove this. I think there might be a negative correlation with how well a software engineer can write a CV and how well they can write code. And most technical people's CVs are pretty bad. You know, normally it's a box of like 1,000 keywords of every technology they've ever touched in pretty their much. Career. And so really what we've got good at focusing on is like, what are you good at and what do you want to be working on? And those two things are really what should drive a lot of the matching. And so that's really where the insight came from. We were able to build a cloud-based programming environment that enabled us to validate those skills and kind of build from there.
So we're coming upon a decade. I can't believe that you've been doing this for 10 years. And I'm sure that's a mind-blowing, you know, to you as well. But I want to talk about those early days. Once a product launched into market and was really, truly commercially viable, what was one of those, as a business owner and an entrepreneur, what was one of those hard lessons, you know, those early lessons learned the hard way about running a business, building teams? Maybe it was a preconceived notion. Maybe you had a hypothesis how this product would do in a certain market or sector, and it didn't.
I think that there are so many lessons and learnings. And people often ask me this question, it's like, what mistakes did you make? And I completely reframe that question, which is, we were really big into the lean startup methodology, which is a very experiment-driven methodology, right? You have a hypothesis, you want to test that hypothesis, learn from that hypothesis, and react. And I think we were very, very good at just going through that, very low ego, and actually just learning consistently, you know, what does work, what doesn't work, and react. So we changed pricing models consistently, right? We would experiment with different pricing systems. We changed the fundamental product numerous times throughout that journey and until we landed on this kind of like reverse marketplace model where the company pitches the engineer as the first move. And I think that you really have to get away from this idea of like mistakes and failures in the early days of trying to find product market fit, because I think you're just going to be way too harsh on yourselves. And instead, it's really taking this experiment-driven, low-ego approach of testing consistently, learning consistently. And if you do that over time, it's amazing what can compound. And to think, you know, we've been doing this for 10 years this year, which is mind-blowing. All of those mistakes, all of those lessons, all of those experiments have just compounded over those 10 years to build the company to where it is today.
I love it. Let's talk a little bit about, you know, the mission statement and how that's evolved over time. What how do you define the mission of HackerJob?
So in a sentence, we're trying to celebrate the humans behind the technology. And I think what makes our business so special, and I think what's enabled us to create such a powerful culture, is we are helping companies and technologists effectively build the future. And you can use some real examples here. The two that I love to use is SpaceX. Mm-hmm. And when you see the SpaceX rocket self-land itself in the ocean, to me, it is utterly mind-blowing that is going on. And at the end of the day, it is just humans behind that. Humans are the ones that have built that rocket, and a lot of it is software, that have built the software that controls that. And another amazing example, I've never seen a product capture the imagination as much as ChatGPT did, you know, at the back end of 2012 and into 2022, sorry, and into last year.
Yep.
And again, at the end of the day, that is just some incredible technologists at OpenAI that are building that product. And so I love the fact that we've built a product and a platform that brings those two things together. And I think often the popular media narrative is that technology is bad and it's going to take everyone's jobs. And, you know, there's like this doomsday fear that we have, especially with AI. And I think we forget to celebrate the people behind these products that are building the future. And that's really our mission statement and what we want to do.
I mean, I couldn't agree more. And it's right. It's how do you find that happy medium? At the end of the day, yes, the machines are doing a lot of the advanced machine learning work, but it's humans behind it that are creating it. So let's pivot a little bit. And I do want to discuss diversity, and I do want to talk about diversity in tech. And then I also want to kind of dig into how the whole AI is playing into it as well there too. But you guys have a 2023 report regarding diversity in the tech industry. What are some of those key insights that are pointing us in the right direction?
Yeah, so I think that overall in the early career space, we are definitely making progress. So we are definitely seeing more diverse talent come through in either people directly out of college or actually school leavers, which is amazing to see. And I think the two primary areas we see that is in the gender diversity and the ethnic diversity that we're seeing in there. And often people have different D&I targets, but they're the two broadest categories that we'll see come up most frequently. I think where the biggest challenges still lie is in the senior technical positions. As you get more and more senior inside these organizations, gender diversity falls off a cliff. It's very low single digits when you're starting to get into the hands, the senior hands-on tech roles and the hands-off manager roles. And so amazing that we've making progress at the early careers level. How do we then nurture that talent and develop that talent, which people often forget that I in DE&I, inclusion, is a really important part of that.
Why do you think the issue is more senior up the ladder? Is it just because that we're only making those strides in the lower tenured folks now, and they're not senior enough yet? Is this still the changing of the guard?
I think that's it. I mean, it takes time. You know, you're not going to make these changes overnight, and it's going to take time for the early careers talent to develop. Now, something that we've got to be really mindful of, though, is are those people developing and are they progressing or are they leaving? And are they actually leaving the tech sector altogether? And that's where this inclusion piece is so, so important. I think there's often too much of a focus on the hiring numbers and not enough focus on how we're doing retention and enablement of the employees themselves.
Retention is such a key factor. And I see it a lot too in the tech world too. There's a lot of folks that are coming out into tech that are individual contributors versus being people leaders and people managers. And some of them don't have the right mentorship and the right nurturing and, you know, leadership programming around them, and that falls at the hands of the organizations that they're joining. What are you seeing as far as some advancements in this space as early leadership and development in tech?
I don't think this problem is unique to tech. So as somebody, you know, we run a company of 120 people, and I have seen us do it so often where we'll promote our best IC into a management role and just assume that because they were a great IC, they're going to be a great manager.
Not everyone's mental.
Don't put support around them. And, you know, either they're not meant to lead or they've just never been taught. It's a completely different skill to manage people and lead people than it is to do the job yourself. And I've learned that the hard way as a leader. You know, over the last few years, we have definitely promoted people into roles and then not supported them. And something that we're really thinking about now with our people team is how do we support first-time managers as we promote them through it? Because so many people do want that progression. And I see that in tech, but I also see that in sales. I see that in marketing. I see that in HR. So I think there's a big, big challenge, definitely in the startup and scale-up world, where we kind of promote and don't support. And it's kind of that sink or swim environment that we provide for people, which isn't productive.
Yeah. And going back to the early part of the conversation about diversity too, I mean, I see it in the schools here too. My daughter's 11 years old and she's in, you know, the STEAM program, and to see young girls that are into tech and robotics and computer programming. And there's so many cool games out there and apps right now for young kids to use, and not just, you know, little boys, but little girls in all different parts of the world. That's really encouraging. So it's about how do we use this tech to drive diversity? And a point that you're you know, always interested on is, again, when we get back to AI and machine learning, how can we use this technology to improve diversity in hiring moving forward?
Yeah, so we've been working on something for quite some time now, which we're really excited about, and it's being tested by a few of our customers. So there's a couple of different things that are coming together that are going to enable us to test this. Firstly, as part of the HackerJob experience, our users, candidates, can decide to self-disclose DE&I data. And about 80% of our users self-disclose, which is amazing. So we capture opt-in data across gender, ethnicity, neurodiversity, LGBTQ plus status, veteran status, disability, and any reasonable adjustments you need in the interview process. So that's firstly really important because you can't improve what you can't measure. And so many organizations in the recruitment process are still using visual representation, which is terrible. Basically just looking at somebody and guessing their gender.
Right, there's so many biases, innate biases within that, yep.
Disaster. Or they're waiting for candidates to self-disclose, but they're probably going to get maybe between 5 and 20% of the candidate self-disclosing. Mm. So a relatively low sample size. So that's one thing that's really important to this. The second thing is what's happened with large language models, which is really, really exciting. So if you think all a large language model is it enables a computer to understand natural text or natural language. And if you think about how recruitment's always been done, it's been very keyword focused, right? Mm-hmm. So like I'm looking for a Java engineer. I'm going to write this Boolean string that's going to find Java in a CV and Java in a job description and match off the two of them. What you can then do with LLMs is add a lot more context behind that, because now an LLM can understand a full requirement, a sentence, a job description, etc., not just the keyword, and can match with all of that context. And then what's even more impressive is explain back to the user why this candidate has matched for this role. Why is this important? Well, by doing this, you're creating a whole new skills taxonomy. Your skills are not no longer keywords. They can be much more contextualized skills. And my view on how you solve the D&I problem in a sourcing perspective is you need to increase top of funnel attraction. 100%. You have to get more diverse candidates in the funnel in the process. And if you are just using keywords, you're going to minimize or reduce the total talent pool that you can do. Through this approach on the product that we're building and being tested, actually, we're able to increase that top of funnel because we can build relationships with skills that are far more rich and far more complex. And so a company can tell us, these are my D&I goals. We can combine the self-disclosed data with our new LLM matching and actually then show talent that they previously wouldn't have seen. And something that's really interesting in the early user testing, about 30% of the requests that are getting sent to candidates, those candidates wouldn't have been shown on our old matching system. So this is genuinely moving the needle, which we're really excited by.
Gentlemen across the nation, I have an urgent message for you. This episode of the podcast is brought to you by Manscaped. The brand that took your balls to space is now launching them to the Ultrasphere. Introducing the Lawn Mower 5.0 Ultra. Featuring a new cutting-edge design and next-generation dual skin-safe blade heads for different shaves. It's pretty much a spaceship to take your boys downstairs to the next level. Join the 9 million men worldwide who trust Manscaped with the brand new Lawn Mower 5.0 Ultra by going to manscaped.com for 20% off plus free shipping when you use the code PODCAST, P-O-Z-C-A-S-T. High tech for low places. That's Manscaped. And I got to tell you, since I got my hands on this pair of trimmers, my life downstairs has changed. My wife loves it, if you know what I mean. But let me tell you, this has made it so much easier to take care of what I need to do downstairs. You know what? Take it on the go. Manscaped has you covered. This puppy comes with a travel case and even a travel lock to avoid any accidental powering on or weird looks in the airport. Guys, check this out. Go to manscaped.com, get 20% off when you use the code PODCAST, plus free shipping. I'm telling you, your balls have been through enough. It's time to go ultra with Manscaped. Check it out. That is fantastic, and kudos to that. And I want to kind of double back to a point that's an interesting one around neurodiversity in hiring. And as a recruiter, it's really forcing a lot of us to dig in deep to our, you know, our EQ and be able to understand and be empathetic and be able to have conversations with folks, with people that may not be as outgoing, they may not be as extroverted, they may not bring a level of excitement and energy to a conversation that the hiring manager or company would want to have, but they bring such skills and other pieces as well there too. And it's tricky. Right, like some jobs do require, if it's like a sales job or certain things or certain outgoing personality traits, but others don't. How is the technology helping level the field with neurodiverse candidates?
So I think let's talk about candidate experience and through the lens of candidate experience, because I think it's such a hot topic. Everyone loves to talk about candidate experience, and I think this is a real example. So I think that companies generally design interview processes that start with the company or start with the job. So we're going to design an interview process that actually is kind of self-fulfilling, right? We're going to design it so that it suits us. And we might be optimizing for the shortest amount of hiring manager time, the most technical rigor, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Different things you could optimize for. I think if you really care about neurodiversity specifically, you cannot have a one-size-fits-all interview process. You have to have a candidate-led approach. because you might have a very, and ultimately your goal should be for that candidate to give themselves the best opportunity of demonstrating their skill set and their experience in the interview process. So if you are dyslexic and we are doing a timed online mm-hmm. assessment, this was a real example we had with one of our large telco customers. You could see, because we've got the self-disclosed data, you could see that dyslexic candidates were having a much lower pass rate than non-dyslexic candidates right. because of the time pressure that they'd put on each question, right? And there might be some logical reasoning behind why you would do that from a company perspective, but actually from a candidate experience perspective, they should have designed the process with the candidate first. So the best examples I've seen is some great companies out there where when it gets to the technical interview stage, they actually give the candidate different routes to go down. You can do an online timed assessment if you want. You could do a live pair programming interview if you want, or you could do like a take home project and take a week on it. And actually what we want to see is you performing at your best with your technical skills. And by personalizing the experience, you are then creating a more inclusive process. You're enabling people to do the best that they can do in that interview process. And I think that's really where we can move the needle from a neurodiversity perspective.
That is so spot on. And it's such a, it's so refreshing to hear that companies are doing that versus one size fits all and being like innately selfish about the process and making it more about, again, it comes down to the candidate experience. And I think that so many companies are still in this old school mindset of what it has to be. Right. What does it have to be? Completely off script, off topic conversation here. You know, I talk a lot about the future of the resume and your job identity. Right. We're tied to this document. Right. But what you know, for me, what excites me is this concept of how do we utilize blockchain and other employment tools of verification to kind of tell your career story that's not in this traditional resume format. What's kind of your hot take on resumes and the future of owning your career narrative?
So one thing we've always wanted to do, we've not figured out how to do this, right? I mean, the problem with a resume is it's a very 2D document, right? Mm-hmm. It's like very static and it's like got the best practice, which is your work experience. It needs to be on two pages, these bullet points, etc. When I interview people, I'm far more interested in what books are they reading? What podcasts are they listening to? Mm-hmm. You know, what hobbies do they have? Like, I want to get the 3D version of that individual, right? I want to know all the stuff outside of the 9-to-5. Because actually, like some of our best employees, right, might not have a great CV, unquote, unquote, but they've got this utter drive and this growth mindset. And in their spare time, they're learning all this, they're consuming all this content and listening to this podcast. So I'm really interested in how can we build resumes that are far more rich and dynamic about everything that that individual is consuming, learning, interested in.
It's more like a very standard like profile. It's more like a dating profile, Mark. No, but I mean, I'm joking, but I mean that the right way because you want to get to know the person. You want to be able to pick out what those soft skills are and how they're going to contribute to your team, how they're going to complement your team, right? Like, listen, let's call it what it is. There's a lot of roles out there at certain levels where you have to have certain skills, certain technical requirements for the role you need to bring that experience. But what about all those elements after that, right? Those innate things, those elements that you're going to bring to the table in the team. How do you understand that in a resume versus the interview until you get there? Like, it's exciting.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And look, I think, again, you combine two interesting topics, right? So what is a lot of these LLMs enabled us to do is this lazy apply where candidates are just spamming out thousands of applications, right? Which is really annoying. And there are now tools that will rewrite your CV for every job description you apply for. So what is going to become more and more important is how do you verify skills? How do you verify experience? And that's where blockchain technology could be really interesting. In order to be able to do that. So it'll be interesting to see how those two technologies play off each other.
I do have a problem. There are platforms out there that are rewriting resumes. As a recruiter, I'm talking with my recruiter hat on now, my recruiter hat. As you mentioned, that they're rewriting resumes based on the job description, but they're not verifying that you actually have those skills. And I think candidates really need to be mindful of not falling into that trap. There are a lot of people out of work right now. And a lot of people, when you're out of work, you do desperate things, but I will always advise candidates to be truthful. Don't just feed a job description into one of these bot machines and spit out, you know, bullet points for your resume that you don't have. It's doing a disservice.
I totally agree. And there's two things I'd add to that. Like, one, a resume is a story. So you need to get really good at storytelling. There's absolutely no issue with that at all. Like, you need to build your career narrative, but it's got to be verifiable and it's got to be true. And the second one is, there are these like TikTok videos that go viral of somebody using ChatGPT or one of these tools to cheat a technical interview. And it's great. And it's great viral content. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, you're going to have to go and do that job. And if you don't have the skills to go and do that job, you're going to get found out at some point. Now, in some large organizations, maybe it'll be 6 months before you're found out. And that's probably a problem in itself. In most organizations, I suspect you're going to get found out much, much sooner. And then you're going to get fired and you're going to be back to being unemployed. So I think you need to get really good at telling a great story about your career. But it has to be verifiable. It has to be grounded in truth. Otherwise, you're just doing yourself a disservice.
What are you seeing right now? We're recording this midway through January, and it's probably going to come out in about 4 weeks from now. And already this point, two and a half weeks into 2024, we've seen almost 100,000 tech layoffs already in the States. Record highs, a lot of people out of work. And we've spoken about this ad nauseum, you know, the reasons why behind it. But are we going to get to this point of a recalibration? Is the market going to open back up? If you're looking into your crystal ball, what do we got going on, Mark, in the next year, 18 months?
Yeah, and it's interesting. It's not just tech. I think Citibank this week announced 40,000 layoffs. So it's not just tech. That's the IB sector. What would be my take? My take is that there is still significant demand for technologists, but in more and more non-technology industries. So what do I mean by this? I think a lot of the tech layoffs that we hear about are layoffs that are happening in technology companies. But technology as a domain now goes across every single industry, right? So, and quite often these layoffs that we hear in technology companies aren't actually the tech people being laid off.
It
might
roles.
Be somebody in sales and marketing. Exactly, right? So recruiters are often the ones that are laid off inside Google.
Right.
And if a recruiter is laid off inside Google, that would be considered a tech layoff because Google is a tech firm.
Well, if they're not hiring, they don't need
language matters. Yeah. Right, totally, right? So I think language matters, and we're trying to understand what matters there. So I think we're seeing ongoing demand in, like I said, non-traditional tech sectors. So, you know, people going through big digital transformation programs, people that are, you know, really thinking about what does our business look like over the next 10 years are still going to hire tech people. I think that the challenge that we have in tech is a systemic challenge. There are still more jobs when you include full employment than there are talent to fill those jobs. And there's always desire for really great technologists. I think the big unknown, the big question mark is like, what does the GitHub Copilot tool impact have, right? So actually, what are the efficiencies that you're going to be able to get from an engineer? And does it end up meaning that kind of like every engineer has the capability of a senior engineer? What is the future of a junior engineer in that context? In our 2023 report, junior software engineer salaries dropped about 20% year on year, right? So what's going on there is going to be really interesting to watch. And especially when you think about then D&I and the lens that that has. So my summary would be, it's going to be tough. I think there will still continue to be a lot of inbound applications for companies, which drives a lot of noise and a lot of frustration. But I think that this is a systemic longer term problem that I don't believe is going to be, simply solved by these companies doing layoffs.
It's so interesting too, and you alluded to it before, this problem in hiring right now. It's this easy apply button, right? And it's just causing an insane volume of inbound applications, and it's flooding the system and log jams, and it's creating companies that were never high volume recruiting operations. Now they have to sift through so many different applications. So I am hopeful that there are going to be a lot of new tools out there for sifting and sourcing. And it's going to be even more important for folks to be able to stand out in the right way, but even more important for companies not to just use basic keywords, because that's how people are going to be gaming the system. And a lot of good candidates are going to fall through the cracks. So it's a bit of a double-edged sword. I don't know what the answer is, but at the end of the day, in my professional opinion, it's going to come down to good humans and good recruiters with the ability to use great tools like you guys have over at HackerJob. What's on the horizon? Give us some alpha. What's coming out this year? What are some of the things that you're excited for?
Yeah, so I was kind of touching on it. So internally, it's branded as Sapience, which is the code word for it. But we are really excited at combining our first-party data with some of these LLMs to see what's possible. So, we have now got hundreds of millions of data points on our users. And what's really interesting is we're plugged into so many applicant tracking systems, we actually track all of the interview data as well. And so we can combine that with this much richer matching experience. It's got a lot more context behind it. And then explain back to users why our system is matching talent. And I think that is going to drive a tremendous amount of efficiency inside technical recruitment teams. Mm. I am steadfast in my belief that AI is not going to replace humans in the hiring process. I think that the hiring process is an innately human process. Yes. I think us that work as recruiters or work in this industry can sometimes forget how big a deal it is changing jobs, how big a deal it is interviewing, and the fact that you can speak to a human on the other side is so valuable. I say until it's AI hiring AI, I think there's going to need to be humans in the process.
Until it's AI and AI, yep.
Which might happen in our lifetime. But I do think that tools like HackerJob and the other tools that are getting built, these co-pilot style tools, will make recruitment teams a hell of a lot more effective, and you'll be able to do a lot more with less. So that's really what we're pushing and working on.
And that's why I really like the reference to co-pilot. Whenever we call technology a co-pilot, not just driving the ship, right? I think it's a very spot on assessment. So this is fantastic. Great tool out there. Everyone check out HackerJob. We'll link it up in the comments down there. What's scaring you right now? What's keeping you up at night as a business owner?
The world is uncertain, right? The world is uncertain. And it's really interesting. In my time, 10 years now, almost 10 years of doing this business, you know, the last majority of that was in a bull run in the economy. It was relatively peacetime in the world. There's always conflicts going on, but it was relative peacetime. We now have two wars ongoing. The economy is still kind of like really hard to predict. Like a lot of people would have thought the US would have been in a recession. Somehow the US has kind of escaped a recession. Is it going to be a soft landing this year? Is it going to be a bumpy landing this year? Are there going to be rate cuts this year? Are there not going to be rate cuts this year? So I think there's a lot of uncertainty in the world. And therefore, there's two things that I take to that. One is we have to focus on the things that we can control and really, really obsess over that. But we have to be very, very humble, really listen to our customers, really listen to what's happening, 100%. And react and iterate quickly. And I think that's the only way we can do it. But I would definitely say it's the uncertainty in the world right now that would be keeping me up.
It's fantastic. Spot on. I'm with you on that. So, Mark, let's bring it home here. Two questions I ask every guest, because I just love to get the perspective over the year. What is the single greatest piece of advice you've ever received that you take action on daily?
What a fantastic question.
A mantra, something to start your day, something that just gets you revved up.
No, and one comes to mind. So very early on in the HackerJob days, I used to feel the need to speak a lot. And I love speaking. I'm a very people person, etc. But even when I didn't know the answer, I would speak a lot. And maybe try and blag my way through things, maybe try and talk my way through it. And somebody sat down with me, I won't say who, because I don't know if he'd want it to be public or not. He said, Mark, you're clearly very bright. You clearly got a good mind. But you should listen more than you talk. And actually, you should reserve your voice for the last voice in a room. And I don't stick to this all the time. The team will tell you that one of my annoying habits is I often talk over people. But it is something I often think about, and especially with customers, is like we are there to listen and ask really good questions and continue to listen. I think somebody that is very outgoing and loves talking and would love to sit and chat to you for hours and hours and hours, it can be sometimes hard to apply, but it's something that I really try and live by. And it's even more important when you've got the job title CEO, because your voice carries even more weight than what you think it does. So I might make a throwaway comment and somebody might be like, oh, Mark told me to go and do that, right? And I'm like, no, I didn't mean that. It was just a throwaway comment. So I really try and listen before I jump in to conversations.
That applies to everybody there. And I'm laughing. I'm nodding my head as you're saying that, because I took that advice many years ago and it was a game changer for me. Especially, I mean, if we're talking right now as a podcast host, the ability to listen, because that's when you're going to hear the insights and the gems and not jump ahead to the next question and not always be looking down at where do I have to take this? But something interesting, like earlier in the conversation, you said neurodiversity. I wrote it down and I made sure I went back to it because it was something I wanted to dig into. And that brought out interesting parts of the conversation and insights. And maybe it's an insight that leads to a product innovation. So there's so many things that you could just do by slowing down. So Mark, last but not least, you know, you look back on your journey, your entrepreneurship journey, your life journey, and it wasn't always sunshine and rainbows. There were those tough times. And during those tough times, you had to dig down deep and harness your own inner tenacity to pull you up and drive you forward. In the same breath, you're celebrating a decade of this business, of being an entrepreneur, of building a company that employs 120 people, lives that you're helping, they're able to support their families, and you're supporting businesses, and you sit here with gratitude and respect for what you have built. What keeps you focused? What is your guiding light? Mark Chaffee, what is your North Star in life?
I would love to have like a very beautifully descriptive.
Just go with it.
But I like answering these questions with gut feels instead. And I was actually discussing this with my coach last week. I said, do you know what? I absolutely love my job. And he was like, what made you say that? And I was like, I was, you know, I took 10 days off over Christmas and came back, and I didn't feel as refreshed as I thought I was going to feel. Didn't feel that like, oh yeah, I feel really refreshed. I got loads of sleep and everything. And then one day back, just one day, I was like, oh my God, I love it. And what I love about what I get to do, and this is a slightly different framing to framing on the answer to the question, is there are no rules. And I think that, again, it comes back to that naivety of never working inside another company. I often say this to our business. I want HackerJob to be the Wild West. We have to stay within the bounds of the law. Right. And outside of that, we can do whatever we want. And right now, it's really tough. There's a lot of uncertainty. There's a lot of problems we have to solve. And I remind our team, we're the ones that are going to solve this. Nobody is going to solve this for us. We are trying to build something that has not been built before. And so I think that that everyday solving problems, the resilience you have to go through those ups and downs, and to do it with such fantastic people around us, is why I absolutely get to love my job. And then to come back to our mission, I'm so proud that we're working on a business that genuinely impacts people's lives every day. You know, last year, more than 100,000 candidates used HackerJob as part of their job search. That's such a big impact that our product is able to have. And so that is something that's so deeply fulfilling to me. So something about the autonomy, something about the problem solving, and really the impact that our product gets to have.
I love it. And it's such, the mission has evolved. The mission has come to life, and the mission has grown with the organization. I love it. Mark, I want to thank you so much for your time. I want everyone to check out hackajob.com/talent, see what's happening over there. It's really exciting what they're building, either for yourself as a candidate or for an organization. Mark, where else can folks connect? Where could they find more?
Yeah, big on LinkedIn. So feel free to reach out on LinkedIn. Always interested in having conversations with people. I try and regularly post on there. Don't post so much on X or Twitter. But I'm often on it. I'm one of those silent users that never tweets, but it's always seeing what's popping on. A lurker.
There we go. Mark, hang with me for one second here. It was a great conversation. Everyone out there, I hope this show resonated with you. If it did, leave a review rating. It goes a long way. You know where to find out more at thepodcast.com. Follow us on all of our social media channels. Remember, look out for one another, be good to yourself, be better to others, and catch us next week for another great episode of the podcast. Take care, everybody.
Wisdom is forever, but for us, it's time to go. Thank you for joining us. Luckily, we'll be back with our next episode soon, jam-packed with more incredible humans. Thank you for listening, subscribing, and sharing. To join the conversation, search The Podcast on LinkedIn. And to catch up on past episodes and more info, please visit www.thepodcast.com.